Reading from the Word of God, the second epistle to the Corinthians, chapter 8. Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the ecclesias of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality, for to their power I bear record. Yea, and beyond their power, they were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we should receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering of the saints. And this they did, not as we hoped, but first gave their own selves to the Lord and unto us by the will of God. Insomuch that we desired Titus that as he had begun, so he would also finish in you the same grace also. Therefore, as ye abound in everything, in faith, and utterance, and knowledge, and in all diligence, and in your love to us, see that ye abound in this grace also. I speak not by commandment, but by occasion of the forwardness of others, and to prove the sincerity of your love. For ye know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that ye through his poverty might be rich. And herein I give my advice, for this is expedient for you who have begun before, not only to do, but also to be forward a year ago. Now therefore perform the doing of it, that as there was a readiness to will, so there may be a performance also out of that which ye have. For if there be first a willing mind, it is accepted according to that a man hath, and not according to that he hath not. For I mean not that other men be eased and ye be burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he that had gathered much had nothing over, and he that had gathered little had no lack. But thanks be to God, which put the same earnest care into the heart of Titus for you. For indeed he accepted the exhortation, but being more forward, of his own accord he went unto you. And we have sent him the brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the ecclesias. And not that only, but who was also chosen of the ecclesias to travel with us with this grace, which is administered by us to the glory of the same Lord and declaration of your ready mind, avoiding this, that no man should blame us in this abundance which is administered by us, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. And we have sent with them our brother, whom we have oftentimes proved diligent in many things, but now much more diligent upon the great confidence which I have in you. Whether any do inquire of Titus, he is my partner and fellow helper concerning you. Or our brethren be inquired of, they are the messengers of the ecclesias and the glory of Christ. Wherefore, show ye to them and before the ecclesias the proof of your love, and of our boasting on your behalf.
My dear brethren and sisters, in the Lord Jesus Christ, and young people, you know it is written in the Acts of the Apostles that God is taking out of the nations a people for his name. And for that purpose, brethren and sisters, he sent into the world, the Roman world, the apostles of the Christ, who carried that message from the length and breadth of that Roman world, preaching it to men and women and inviting them to come out of the nations and to form the ecclesia which was to bear God's name. That work, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, involves ourselves. That tremendous movement which gained its impetus from the day of Pentecost has rolled over the centuries of time and has called men and women from all ranks of life to form what is known as the Ecclesia. It has called them from different walks of life, with different temperaments and characteristics, men and women, bond and free, Jew and Greek, and has made them all one in Christ Jesus. And there should be, brethren and sisters, an absolute oneness, not only amongst ecclesias individually, but collectively all together. Every ecclesia should look upon itself as a foundation part, an integral part, we should say, of the purpose of God with the earth, namely that we should glorify Him in our being. And we've come together this Easter, coming out of the Old Testament from the days of Elijah and Elisha, to a different type of study, to speak about one such ecclesia, who, brethren and sisters, I would say this without fear of contradiction, was the best ecclesia that ever existed, and has never been matched in the history of the truth. And we've deliberately chosen this subject of the Philippians because we feel, brethren and sisters and young people, that during the past 12 months so much anguish and trouble has come upon us that we're not able to reach any lower ebb, and we either go under or from this point onwards we come up. And hence we deliberately have chosen the Philippians for that very reason, that we might all be lifted up this weekend to a contemplation of a group of brethren and sisters who formed the best ecclesia that ever existed upon the face of this earth. They were mighty people, and the epistle which the Apostle Paul wrote to them is full of glowing comfort and encouragement, brethren and sisters, that should be able to lift us above the present in which we live. We live in the blackest hour of Gentilism. In times past, we tend to speak of the degradation of Gentilism, of the agony of living in the world as brethren and sisters in Christ. If that we say that in the past, what do we say today? Never before, brethren and sisters, have we seen such utter perverseness and degradation as we see on every hand. We see men and women acting like animals and worse than animals. We see moral standards which were at least nominally accepted in the Gentile world now becoming immoral, so that it's immoral to be moral. And we're living in what is commonly known as the permissive society, which means that you can do what you like. And if you don't do what you like, then you are an immoral person in the eyes of the world. So that the world has come to that position called by Isaiah when he said they call evil good and good evil. And that's exactly where we stand today. And the saddest thing of all is to see that spirit come into the brotherhood. Not only, brethren and sisters, on a moral front, but on a doctrinal front. And I believe, and I don't care who challenges me on this, I believe that from this point onwards, the brotherhood in this country is going to stand a severe trial and a test. And I would prophesy, brethren and sisters, that many will succumb. Because if prophecy means anything, if the precedents which have been laid down in the Word of God as concerning the conduct of flesh under such trial is anything, then if we succeed in beating this present trial, we will be the first generation ever to do so. And because of the pressures of the age, because, brethren and sisters, of the pressure of immorality, of liberalism, of materialism, which is tearing the vitals out of the truth, but because of those pressures to which we are all susceptible, I can see in the future, my dear brothers and sisters, such gatherings as this getting smaller and smaller. And that's looking upon the gloomy side of it. And I sincerely hope and pray that I'm wrong. And it is for that reason that we want to present before you an ecclesia that did it degraded self, that didn't retrogress in the truth, but progress in the truth. We want to present to you a group of brethren and sisters who were the absolute epitome, as far as an ecclesia was concerned, of what an ecclesia should be, who were striving together for the faith of the gospel, and who put their shoulders behind the Apostle Paul when all the world had forsaken him, and were loyal to the very end. Such brethren and sisters we ought to make our own, and to be in fellowship with them in every sense of the word. They were wonderful people, and I believe that we're going to have a very refreshing time together considering them. And in the first talk or two, perhaps, we want to try and sketch for you, brethren and sisters, the background of this ecclesia. What sort of people they were? Where did they come from? What sort of walk of life were they used to? What were the influences upon them? And the impact of the truth which caused them to come away from those influences and to stand aside and to defy the might of the Roman world. They were remarkable people. In the fourth chapter of Philippians, Paul addresses them in these terms. Now, this is the sort of people they were. He says, "Therefore, my brethren, dearly beloved and longed for, my joy and crown, so stand fast in the Lord, my dearly beloved." And those were terms of endearment, brethren and sisters, which were only used in respect to one other ecclesia, which wasn't far behind this one, and they both came from the same region. The other ecclesia to whom those similar words were directed were the Thessalonians. And they lived side by side geographically, as you'll see by that map. They didn't live very far apart, the Thessalonians and the Philippians. They both came from Macedonia. And in Macedonia, the gospel found root as it never found root in any other place. And there was a reason for that, as you'll see as we proceed. But Paul found an astounding response in Macedonia. And to the Macedonians, he directed words like that: "Therefore, my brethren, my dearly beloved and longed for, my joy and my crown, stand fast in the Lord, my dearly beloved," he tells them. Dearly beloved. And the compound word there includes the word agape. They were loved by the Apostle Paul in the deepest sense of the term. He loved them with an agape love. He was going to lay down his life for them. Why? Because they were laying down his life for them, as we shall see later on. And together they joined together. The bread and the wine and the meat offering, they all came together in one great sacrifice, and Paul was prepared to be the drink offering, pour over the top of them, that consuming it together they should all go up to God. It wasn't a matter of him laying down his life for them, it was a matter of them laying their lives down for him as well. And they were his dearly beloved, agape, because they understood the sacrificial love of God and were prepared to act upon it. They were remarkable people. He calls them my crown. My crown. We'll come to look at that word a little more closely when we come to the fourth chapter. But of course the word in the Greek is stephanos. It's the coronial wreath which was given to the victor in the Olympic Games which were held in those days. Particularly the games which were held in those days at Corinth, where yearly they would gather. So this enormous gathering of people would come to witness those games, and the victor would be crowned with this coronial wreath. And Paul saw the day coming, brethren and sisters, when he would present himself before the judge of all the earth, the leader of our faith, who had won the race of faith, as Hebrews 12 says. And Paul, who had been the victor, would present himself there, and he would be crowned with the Philippians as an absolute token of Paul's victory. And they were his victory, and that's how he looked upon them. And you know, he held them up to the ecclesial world. He held them up and said, "You have a look at that piece, that crowd of people. They are my victory." And he exhorted them to stand fast in the Lord, because he carried their example all over the Roman world, quoting them to different ecclesias, to have a look at those people. And everywhere Paul saw them as his coronial wreath, his joy and crown. Wonderful people. You know, in the first chapter, he addresses them in another term of endearment, which is extremely expressive. when he says in the first chapter of verse 8 that God was his record, how greatly I long after you all in the bowels of Jesus Christ. And that word bowels is a good translation of the Greek word. It literally means the physical organs, but used, of course, as a very intense form of affection. So instead of using the term affection or love or filio, whatever you like, he expresses it in this way, the bowels of Jesus Christ, the very intensest form of affection. So he says, look, I call God to be my witness that I have a longing for you Philippians with a depth of affection which Jesus Christ has for the Philippian ecclesia. And Christ had the Philippians, brethren and sisters, deep in his bowels. And that was the sort of love that Paul had for them, because Christ had that love for them. Do you know, you remember on the way to Damascus, when Paul was apprehended by the blinding light from heaven, the Lord said to him, Paul, Paul, or Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? And in persecuting the first century Christians, Paul was persecuting the Lord himself. And in the case of the Philippians, that was intensified, because the Lord loved the Philippians deep down inside. He loved them. And Paul knew that. And so in endeavouring to try and express to them the depth of his love, he says, look, it's not in my bowels I love you, but my association with Christ has taught me that he deeply loves you, and therefore I deeply love you, and I greatly long after you. What sort of people would these? They're not loose words. We are given to exaggerations, brethren and sisters. We're given to flowery forms of speech. We pander to the flesh sometimes with great swelling words. Paul was not a man like that. And yet in this epistle, you see language which borders on the extreme. And you'll see the reason for that too as we develop this theme. Well, you can imagine this man, as he went around the Roman world planting the gospel in various places, being persecuted and finally in prison, and he had a connection with one ecclesia who stood to a man behind him, the Philippians, and no other ecclesia did. And hence he expressed himself in these terms. Let us have a quick look now at some of the verses of endearment, other than these two which are found in this epistle. You take verse 5 of chapter 1. He speaks about their fellowship in the gospel from the first day until now. There was an absolute oneness in the gospel. An absolute oneness in the gospel from the very first day until now. Then again in verse 7, he speaks there, he says that even as it is meet for me to think this of you all, because I have you in my heart, inasmuch as both in my bonds and in the defense and the confirmation of the gospel, ye are all partakers of my grace. So that in every sense of the word, whether it be in his bonds, the Philippians are bound with him. They got fellowship with him. If he's defending the gospel, the Philippians are standing alongside of him. Or if he's pronouncing the gospel and furthering the gospel, the Philippians are in the front line. Wouldn't matter what happened to him, what circumstance overtook him. They were not an ecclesia to back him when he was winning and to pull out when he was losing. They were with him in every sense of the word. And we do not find that today, brethren and sisters. We, especially this present moment of time, do not find that today. We have good brethren, good sisters, who are waiting to back us on certain issues which affect the brotherhood when they see we're winning. But not until. They were not like that. Whether it was in defense, whether it was in defeat, or in advance, they were with Paul. All the way. Not some of the time. That's the sort of people they were. You take verse 27 of chapter 1. He says, only let your conversation be as it becometh the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you, or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that ye stand fast in the one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. You see, brethren and sisters, they were not an ecclesia who put on a show for the Apostle Paul either. They didn't all put their shoulders to the wheel during the special effort when he was there for the week. He says, whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you're standing fast with one mind and striving for the faith of the gospel. That's what sort of people they were. Look at verse 2 of chapter 2. Fulfill ye my joy, that ye be like-minded. You see, there was a joy he had with them, which could be fulfilled. Fulfilled, brethren and sisters. It wasn't a joy which was a half joy. Paul says, look, you only have to continue in this way and you'll fulfill that joy. You look at chapter 2 and verse 12. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. As ye have always obeyed, is what he told the Philippians. Whether present or absent, brethren and sisters, they obeyed him. Why, the Corinthians and the Galatians didn't even believe that he had authority, let alone obey him. But these people accepted that without question, and they always obeyed him, is the Apostle Paul's words. You take verse 17. Yea, he says, and if I be offered upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, he says, I joy and rejoice with you all. I joy and rejoice with you all. A word which almost is the same Greek word. So he says, look, if I'm going to be sacrificed in Rome, if I lose my court case, if I'm given to the executioner's block, and if I'm going to be poured out as a sacrifice, and he had just received, remember this, he had just received a token from the Philippians which said that they were absolutely 100% behind him. They had sent the brother who was esteemed by every single member of the ecclesia. He had not an enemy in that ecclesia. They had sent him because they could send no finer brother. And that brother came and Paul called him the apostle of the Philippians, a term which is only used twice outside the 12, and once it was used of Epaphroditus. And Epaphroditus came as the apostle of those people, and he stood there representing every single one of them. And Paul told him when he wrote that letter, he said, look, if I'm killed and poured out, he said, I consider it an absolute privilege and joy twice to be associated with a sacrifice like that. Because Paul knew that if he died and gave up his life in the service of the truth, they would continue to be a living sacrifice. And so we're going to come and see that in a moment. That's what he's saying, basically. When you have a look at the words which he's using for the pouring out of a sacrifice and pouring on top of another one, as we will show you when we come to him, the pouring out of the sacrifice was one which was total. It was going to be absolutely total. He was going to give his life. Or it may be if the court case went against him. He was confident that it wouldn't. But he says, if I've got to give all, then that drink offering has got to go upon a living sacrifice. And I'm choosing you, Philippians. And I'm going to joy and joy again to be associated with people like you. That's what sort of ecclesia they were. This is extreme language. But that's what sort of people they were. And you know, brethren and sisters, they were not people who could afford to be good either. They lived in dire circumstances. They weren't an ecclesia who could afford to manifest the qualities of Christ and not be questioned. Oh no, they were suffering with the Apostle Paul. This ecclesia, as we will see, brethren and sisters, was born out of an intense campaign of persecution. It was born out of persecution. And when Paul left that city, although he tried his hardest to win for them a measure of freedom, it is obvious he left behind him a legacy of persecution. Every member that was baptized into the Philippian ecclesia went in with their eyes open and their backs bared, and they suffered with him. And every member that came into that ecclesia, brothers and sisters, had to be genuine. Because if you weren't genuine, you wouldn't face this issue. And so every one of them came in under the extreme duress of persecution. And so he was able to tell them that they were going to be a living sacrifice with him. They were not people who could have just afforded to be righteous and get away with it. Every time they manifested Christ, it called down upon them the wrath of the authorities. They lived in a most peculiar circumstance, as we shall see as we develop this theme. And they had this added advantage. They were poor. They were very poor. And that, brethren and sisters, was an added advantage. They were very, very poor people. But you know, their poverty manifested itself in such a way that they became a standing rebuke to the whole ecclesial world for their liberality and their generosity. And in that passage of Scripture, which was read for us this afternoon, in the 2 Corinthians chapter 8, we have a moving testimony to the character of the Macedonians. And I say Macedonians because here not only Philippi is included, but also the other ecclesias of Macedonia, namely those at Berea and at Thessalonica particularly. And here we have the whole region which had brought forth such sterling people. And here the Apostle Paul, brethren and sisters, is writing to the Corinthians. The subject matter is the Jerusalem Poor Fund, a collection which Paul was authorized by the apostles to take up. You see, Paul had another job in the truth, apart from preaching the truth. Right from the outset of his ministry, down in Jerusalem, he was given charge of the collection for the poor fund. That's possibly one of the jobs that we would relegate to somebody who didn't have very much other ability than just to do things which were quite menial. Well, Paul had that job. And he made an issue out of it. He took up that job of collecting money on behalf of Jews down in Judea. And all over the Roman world, the Jews were hated. Not by the ecclesias, but by the world. But Paul called upon the ecclesias to contribute to the poor saints in Jerusalem, not only because they were poor, brothers and sisters, but because there was a principle involved. The principle was that there would be neither Jew nor Greek. Not only that, but the Gentiles had to contribute to the Jew in full recognition that now they were themselves Jews, partakers of the hope of Israel. The Corinthians were stingy. This ecclesia was rife with immorality. There was a question of wrong doctrine here on several issues. And it was an ecclesia that called forth from the apostle words of stinging rebuke. And in order to engender enthusiasm into them for the cause of the Jerusalem fund, he wrote to them concerning the brethren in Macedonia, the Philippians, the Bereans, the Thessalonians. And have a look what he said to them. Now I want to read to you the first five verses of the 2 Corinthians chapter 8. But I want to read from the Revised Standard Version. You can either follow me in the authorized or just listen, you please yourself. But you listen to what sort of people Paul was referring to. He says, "We want you to know, brethren, about the grace of God which has been shown in the ecclesias of Macedonia. For in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of liberality on their part. For they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own free will, begging us earnestly for the favour of taking part in the relief of the saints. And this not as we had expected, but first they gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God." Now you picture that scene. You try and capture in your imaginations that scene as Paul comes to the region of Macedonia. And he finds these brethren and sisters in what he likes to call extreme poverty. And he lays before them the cause of the Jerusalem Poor Fund. And contributions come pouring in. So Paul says, "No, wait, hang on, hey, look, I don't want all this. This is not what I'm after." He called later on in this chapter, as I'll refer to in a moment, all he wants was an equality. He just wanted everybody to equalize out. If you had a bit over, we'll give to someone who didn't have. So he said, "Look, I don't want this. I only want an equality. I don't want you to do this." And you know what they did? They got down on their knees and begged him earnestly for the privilege of giving. Think of that. They begged him earnestly for the privilege of giving. And it was out of their extreme poverty that Paul says they overflowed. They gave too much. And then he wrote to the Corinthians in verse 12 and said this. He says, "For if there be first a willing mind, it is accepted according to that a man hath, and not according to the hath not. For I mean not that other men be eased and ye be burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, and their abundance also may be a supply to your want, that there may be an equality." So Paul says, look, all I want you Corinthians to do is to merely be willing to give as you are able, and that's all that is expected of you. He says, I don't want you Corinthians to give beyond your means so that you become impoverished and we enrich the saints of Judea. I don't want that at all. I want a levelling out. I want an equality, says the Apostle Paul. And that's all that God asks. Remember, however, the Philippians gave too much and they were in extreme poverty. And they begged me for the privilege of giving. Now you think of that. And that's the sort of people that the Philippians were, brethren and sisters. And you can imagine the Apostle Paul's heart bursting within him with love for that ecclesia, that he could take them before the Corinthians and stand the Corinthians on their head with an example like that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if in our own day and generation we could move around with an ecclesia behind us with a spirit like that? Any wonder that Paul said, I want to be poured out upon the top of that crowd. That'll do me. When I die, associate me with that. That's what I want to be associated with. And there is a standing example, brethren and sisters, of their extreme liberality, of their generosity. What a mighty lot of people they were. But Paul says, look, they didn't only give to the Jerusalem fund. This wasn't an outlandish show of generosity in order to impress me. He said, it was quite obvious to me, he said, that long before they ever gave money to the saints in Jerusalem, they had given themselves lock, stock and barrel to the Lord and to me. I own them, they're mine. They've given themselves to me. 100%. They gave them their own souls to the Lord and to us by the will of God. Gave themselves. And they were his to do what he liked with them. And he used them very powerfully, brothers and sisters. And you're going to see as we proceed the expressions of love that he had for them, not only in words, but on occasions when he was passing through those areas. Especially on most important days, he strove to be at Philippi to be with that crowd, to celebrate certain things which he could have in common with them, because he felt a bond with them as he had a bond with no other ecclesia, not even his own at Antioch. Do you know, in this 2 Corinthians chapter 8, he speaks about the Macedonians. That, of course, as I said, was that whole area up there. But you know, although the Macedonians in general were generous to the extreme, yet you know that out of those ecclesias, which would have included, as I said, the ecclesia at Thessalonica, at Berea, and at Philippi, out of those ecclesias, brethren and sisters, who were all extremely generous, the Philippians stood above them all. Now here we have the ecclesias of Macedonia spoken of. But you know what? He separated the Thessalonians from the Philippians to show that the Philippians were even more generous than the Thessalonians and had better standing. You take, for example, in the 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 8. And remember that this is the only other ecclesia to whom such terms of endearment were ever written. That of the Thessalonians. And here in the 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and at verse 8. He told this ecclesia, neither did we eat any man's bread for nothing, but wrought with labour and travail night and day, that we might not be chargeable to any of you. We worked hard, says the Apostle Paul. We didn't work shift work. We worked both shifts, night and day. What for? That he might not be chargeable to the Thessalonians. He didn't want anybody in the Ecclesia of Thessalonica coming up and saying, oh yes, but you know, you couldn't do it without our help. He didn't want that. And so he worked around the clock, brothers and sisters, day and night. And you know something else? Paul traveled with a band of fellow workers. He was the chief speaker. He was the apostle. You know what he did? He worked while the others could go free preaching. You believe that? You read it in the Acts of the Apostles. He worked to pay their wages. And we have brethren today coming up with all kinds of schemes, including me, to get out of work. We might preach the truth. You think of that. So that Paul earned money for them all, that they might be free to preach the truth. What sort of a man have we got in him? And yet even here in Thessalonica, where he was told these Thessalonians similar words and expressions of love and joy as found in that epistle to the Corinthians, or rather Philippians, where he told them, yet nonetheless, brethren and sisters, he did not observe this principle of partaking of their material things. He did not regard them such. Now, who paid his way then? Well, Paul says here that he worked with his own hands night and day, but that wouldn't have paid his way. He needed extra money. Where did he get it from? He got it from the Philippians. Now, you come to chapter 4 of that epistle. So even among the ecclesias of Macedonia, there was a difference. Here in the 4th chapter, verses 15 and 16. Now ye Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no ecclesia communicated with me as concerning giving and receiving, but ye only. For even in Thessalonica, ye sent once and again unto my necessity. For even in Thessalonica, you sent once and again to my necessity. But you see, brethren and sisters, no other ecclesia had communicated with him. The word means to exchange or to be one with him, to unite with him. None had united with him as concerning receiving and giving, but them only. Not that others wouldn't have done it. The Thessalonians would have done it, but Paul wouldn't let them. And he says, when I was in that city, you didn't send once. You didn't send twice. You sent once and again to my necessity. And what's more, he received it. Paul was not afraid. He never hesitated to accept that money, brothers and sisters, because he knew full well that he wouldn't get a letter from the Philippians putting him in their debt. There would never be an expression to the Apostle Paul, we have done this for you, because they had given themselves to him. They belonged to him. They were his. There was never a question with that ecclesia that he would not accept money from them. And in that category, they stood alone in the ecclesial world. So amongst all those ecclesias in Macedonia who had so wonderfully responded and who were tremendously generous, yet even there, the Philippians were segregated from the others as being the only ecclesia who could contribute to the Apostle Paul in all circumstances. And Paul knew full well the motive behind that gift. The motive behind that gift was a tremendous motive. Now, brethren and sisters, when we come to the epistle itself, we find an extremely difficult epistle, an epistle to study. Extremely difficult. For this reason, when you take an epistle, for example, the best example I could take would be the Galatians. You have in the Galatian epistle a very set plan of attack. It's very clear, unambiguous. You can look at Galatians and you can divide it up from that verse to this verse, from that verse to this verse, because it's all in order. It has a specific argument. There is something wrong with that ecclesia. It's got to be righted. Paul's aiming at it, and you can follow his thought. You can almost write the epistle for him once you've studied it, and you can follow him through word by word. You can't do so here. Because you see, when he wrote the Galatians, he would sit down with his pen and he would think about the argument. Now, I've got Judaism to concern with. So first thing, he's got to prove his apostleship. So what does he do? He pens the whole of the first chapter proving his apostleship, setting out the details of how he learnt the truth. and showing that he could not have been taught by men, as the saying is, that his was by direct revelation from God. He had a say every visit he paid to Jerusalem, every contact he had with the apostles. He set it all out in order. So it's not hard to follow it. In this epistle, he doesn't even speak about his apostleship. It's the only epistle with the Thessalonians where that is not mentioned. Those are the two ecclesias, the Macedonians, where Paul never said a word about his apostleship. Why? There was no need of it. It was never questioned. So that doesn't arise here. There was a problem of Judaism in Galatia. So you got no trouble following the argument against Judaism. There's no problem of Judaism here. There was a problem, for example, of immorality in Corinthians. So Paul brings to bear certain scriptures to the Corinthians. There's no such problem here. So what's Paul going to do? Sit down and plan how he's going to write a letter to the Philippians? What can he plan? And this is one of those epistles which doesn't seem to have any set plan. And having studied it, brethren and sisters, it's quite obvious when you study it analytically that it is an epistle which is just thought upon thought running into each other and sometimes repeated. As if a brother would sit down because he's received a gift from somebody, he's been so absolutely overwhelmed by it that he's not thinking about plans of attack or methods or scriptures. He just sits down and writes flowing and glowingly of all the love and the concern he has for them. And so you find in this epistle it's just flowing, ebb and flow of love and joy and happiness to be associated with an ecclesia like that without it seeming any set plan whatever. It's a tremendous contrast to the Galatians. There are very expressive terms in this epistle. You take that one we've just read in verse 15. Now ye Philippians. You think of that. Wouldn't it be lovely? There's a term of familiarity. Ye Philippians. You don't find that in another epistle except in Galatians, and it's in this context, O foolish Galatians. But even the term so seems so glibly to come out of the Apostle Paul's pen, for example. Ye Philippians. There's an absolute oneness here, a familiarity. Ye Philippians. Would to God, brethren and sisters, that if we had such a man as the Apostle Paul, or brethren like him, that they could speak about our ecclesia in those terms. Ye Glenlockians, whatever you like to call yourself. But, you know, ye Philippians. It's an expression of not only of endearment, but I think of one of sort of an attachment there which was so familiar. And he says, you know what you've done for me. And you know, brethren and sisters, even in that statement there, he could have run the danger of boosting their ego, but he never thought of that. Look, he wouldn't have said that to another ecclesia. Who could he say, look, you know what you've done for me? And he even goes to the lengths of saying, well, look, not even the Thessalonians could do that, but you've contributed to me in that city. Now, another ecclesia would have said, yes, we're not bad, you know, are we? We're not real bad. We're even better than the Thessalonians. But Paul was not worried about that. They were not people like that. And so he could express himself in that way. And so, you see, we have this epistle, which basically is written in an appreciation of a gift. And you imagine, brethren and sisters, here's the Apostle Paul in Rome. His circumstances were not all that bad. He had his own hired house. But they were looking grim because on the basis of an impending trial, he would either go a free man or they were going to lop off his head. He didn't know what the result was going to be. He felt confident that he would be released and in one sense was disappointed because he wanted to die, as he told the Philippians. We'll come to that. But he was confident that he'd be released. But his confidence of release, his circumstances, which were all not all that too bad, because he had his own hired house and could meet anybody he liked, but be his personal comfort, as it may, brethren and sisters, as the Apostle Paul was in that prison in Rome, news came quick and fast, one item after another. All Asia is turned away from me. I don't think he meant by that phrase that every ecclesia in Asia had turned away from him. I think he was speaking about a certain class in Asia. All his so-called friends had turned away from him in Asia. All Asia is turned away from me. I don't think he meant by that phrase that every ecclesia in Asia had turned away from him. I think he was speaking about a certain class in Asia. All his so-called friends had turned away from him in Asia. There were bickerings and arguments in the Roman ecclesia itself. And he was in Rome listening to them all, and he reported them all to the Philippians. And they were arguing the toss among themselves. Brethren were doing their utmost to make Paul's condition even more uncomfortable than it was, to get him into more trouble if they possibly could. And he gets news that Demas has forsaken him. And somebody else has forsaken him. There's a doctor looking after him. And he was a Philippian. And one day, he gets a visit from a man who staggers into Rome, practically dead. And he happened to be the apostle of the Philippians. He walked in and contributed something to him in a measure, in a gift. But it wasn't the gift that Paul was concerned about. It was what had brought all back to his mind, brothers and sisters. It brought everything back to his mind. And in all his turmoil and trouble and tribulation, in all the worry that he couldn't get out of that house, he couldn't get to look after the ecclesias, which were the burden upon him, and he wanted desperately to go here, there, and everywhere else. In the midst of all that turmoil, up rolls Epaphroditus, nearly dead, but with a gift to tell him, "We're still behind you." Now that's what he wanted more than anything else. And so he wrote this epistle in appreciation of that gift. You can imagine, therefore, why it just overflows as it does and doesn't set any set plan. How could you plan a letter like that? How could I sit down with a pen in those circumstances, with a lump in my throat as big as this hall, and try and pen an epistle with a plan, with a deliberate plan, thinking it all out in the sense that he thought the Galatians? Impossible. And all he could do was to write in those terms, which were absolutely expressive of his love and concern for them and his happiness to be associated with them. Such were the Philippians. But they were not perfect. They did have a problem, brothers and sisters. They had a problem. It wasn't an ecclesial problem. And we don't want to speak about the Philippians and leave out their problems. We don't want to give the idea that they were perfect. I said earlier they were an epitome of all that ecclesia should be. And of course, that term is relative. Must be qualified, because no ecclesia is perfect. It has in it flesh. None of us is perfect. They were as near as you possibly get to what we might call a good, strong ecclesia. But they had one particular problem. And it was a problem that you could almost forecast in this ecclesia. You think harder, what sort of a problem would have arisen here? And the problem seemed to be this. That although the ecclesia was absolutely one behind the Apostle Paul, they had no moral problems to speak of, that is, major moral problems. None are mentioned. They had no doctrinal problems whatever. There's not even a hint of it in this epistle. There is no question of his apostleship or his authority. It's absolutely taken for granted that they all accept it. And in an ecclesia of that nature, brothers and sisters, you are bound to have people with strong, forceful personalities. It couldn't be otherwise. You wouldn't have an ecclesia like that unless they were. People with very strong characteristics. And when you've got an ecclesia of people with very strong characteristics towards the truth, the trouble that they will run into will be that each of them, striving to emulate Christ, will become closer and closer and closer to the Apostle Paul, and they ran the risk of comparing their relationships with Paul between each other. And that's where the problem arose. And it's obvious by the inferences here and by the bald statements which the Apostle Paul makes that the problem came in when brethren and sisters, and sisters are going to come into this epistle very largely, brethren and sisters, because of their strength of character and tenacity, their faith and their power, became absolutely locked to the Apostle Paul like that. But you see, it's very difficult, brethren and sisters, in circumstances like that, to keep the flesh entirely under. And it was inevitable that somebody should say or point out that their relationship to Paul was very, very, very close. And someone would say, "Well, yes, and my relationship is very, 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 very close." Or someone would say, "You know, Paul left a message with me in this ecclesia. He looks upon me as somewhat of a right-hand man." Yes, but someone else would say, but he's left-handed, you know, and that's where I stand. And this sort of thing. And you see it happening. I've seen it happen. There are certain brethren in this world who have reputations. Big reputations, some of them. And I've seen this very thing going on. People, by vague inference, getting the message home to you that they are their very, very, very close friends. And those people are not necessarily evil. You'll find those people the finest people in the truth. And it is because they are fine people that these other brethren use them in their service, in the service of Christ. But inevitably, if they're not careful, they'll run the risk of starting to compare their relationships with that person. And this is obviously the fault which the Philippians had. And this was the only thing that endangered their relationship with each other. It was a big thing in a sense. Yet it was not in another sense. It was something, brethren and sisters, that came out of their virtues, but which had overbalanced them. So that they began to compare their relationship with the Apostle Paul. And by so doing, they were all striving together for the faith of the gospel, but they were beginning to strive alone. And they were beginning to strive alone that they might impress, first of all, their God, and to show their appreciation to the Apostle Paul of the wonders which he had worked for them. And I believe this is where it was. And you see, you started to have a rising in this ecclesia, not large factions, but factions between prominent people, each of whom would claim Paul as his sympathizer. And of course, this was a thing which Paul had to stop. And so while the general standards of this ecclesia were excellent, there was an absolute necessity, brothers and sisters, that they begin to understand the necessity of being of one mind. And all through this epistle, there's a constant appeal for unity of thinking, a oneness of mind, to esteem each other better than themselves. You have a look at it. First of all, in chapter 1, you take the studied use in chapter 1 of the word all. For example, in verse 1, Paul and Timotheus, the servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus, which are at Philippi. Verse 4, always in every prayer for mine, for you all, making request with joy. Verse 7, even as it is meet for you to think this of you all. And again in verse 7, ye all are partakers of my grace. Verse 8, for God is my record, how greatly I long after you all in the bowels of Jesus Christ. And there's a studied attempt, brothers and sisters, at the use of the word all. And you can imagine, when that epistle was read, how they used to do it, we don't know. But evidently an epistle to an ecclesia would not obviously be handed around one from the other. The Philippians wouldn't be able to wait until their brethren had finished for it. It would have to be read publicly. They wouldn't wait from a letter from the Apostle Paul to go to Brother Jones, Brother Brown, Brother Smith. They'd be around and you're reading over your shoulder. They'd have to read that publicly. And this term would be coming out. All. All. And every brother's waiting for his name to be mentioned. All. I love you all. I deeply love you all. You are all partakers of my grace. I pray for every one of you. And it was fairly obvious what the Apostle Paul was doing. And only a few names are mentioned here. And you can rest assured of this, brethren and sisters, the names that are mentioned in this epistle were names of brethren who were not involved in this sort of thing. Such names as Clement. He would not have been a brother who would have been in association with this sort of thing. He would have been clear of this. Paul wouldn't have mentioned him by name as he did. There's a brother in here called my true yoke fellow. He's not named because there's no need to name him because it's obvious who he is. And I believe it was Luke. I believe it was obviously Luke. And everybody knew him for what he was. And if there's any right-hand man of the Apostle Paul in Philippi, there he was. No need to tell anybody about that. Luke was beyond this sort of thing. But for the rest, it's all. He closes the epistle, brethren and sisters, with the same term. He wasn't going to contribute to this problem. In verse 23, the last verse, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you all. verse 21. Salute every saint in Jesus Christ. And there's a studied attempt to include a lot of them. And you have a look at the exhortations which are given in this epistle to combat this growing concern which he had for these individuals who were starting to work independent of each other. You take, for example, that verse 27 in chapter 1, which we already quoted in another context. But now look at it in this context. He says, only let your conversation be as it becometh the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that ye stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. And the word stand fast there, brethren and sisters, means to stand in a line. To stand in a long line, and everybody keeps in step. That's the Greek word there. Nobody gets out of line. You walk in a level line. I don't love anybody any more than I love the whole lot of you. Walk in line. He tells them in chapter 2, for example, in verses 2 to 4, that they are to be of one accord and of one mind, that nothing is to be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each other esteem better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but on every man also on the things of others. So that they are to esteem a man better than themselves. That was difficult. So you see, there were personalities arising in the ecclesia who felt their relationship with the Apostle Paul was just a shade deeper than the relationship of their fellow. And this is something, brethren and sisters, which I have personally seen myself in my tours of this country, where by vague inferences people give me to understand that their relationship to certain brethren is just a shade deeper than my own. Maybe it's true, I couldn't care less. This I know, that God loves me as much as he loves you. I deeply believe that, and it's all I'm concerned with. And that's all we need to be concerned with. But you see how they can creep into the minds of the strongest of people. And this was the fault that the Philippians were susceptible to. And do you know who led this? It was growing in that ecclesia so that two people were becoming obviously at each other's throats on this issue. Both were wonderful people. Paul expresses himself in a way which demonstrates that these two people were powerful with their testimony to the gospel. He calls them his fellow laborers, both of them. And yet they obviously could not get on in that ecclesia. They were not immoral. They didn't lack faith. They were splendid people. But they were obviously not getting on well together. And the trouble was, I believe, basically an argument over who loved the Apostle Paul better. And they were both sisters. They were both sisters. You think of that. And there were two women in this ecclesia whose influence was tremendous. But they couldn't get on over the Apostle Paul. And he names them in chapter 4. He said, I beseech Euodias, and I beseech Syntyche, that they be of the same mind in the Lord. You imagine that, brethren and sisters. An epistle comes up to the Glenlock ecclesia, or whatever ecclesia you belong to. You think of your own ecclesia. What would happen if somebody of renown, whom your ecclesia greatly loved and respected, wrote an epistle to your ecclesia, which you were all sitting there reading, and we had a brother appointed to do the reading. We have a letter from the Apostle Paul. And the letter says, I beseech Euodias, sitting over there, and I beseech Syntyche, be of the same mind in the Lord. And everybody did. Now look, that could only be done in an ecclesia of the caliber of the Philippians. That could only be done in an ecclesia of that caliber. Because if that ecclesia was any lesser caliber than that, such a statement, brethren and sisters, would be inflammatory. And the very fact that Paul said that, I believe, is one of the greatest testimonies to the character of that ecclesia. Not only so, but you know what the Apostle Paul did? As the letter was read out, he says, look, I entreat thee also, true yoke fellow, and everybody knew who he was talking about, help those women which laboured with me in the gospel. And he said, Clement also, and other my fellow labourers, whose names are in the book of life. You imagine, brethren and sisters, if you were named in a manner like that, I don't want to pick any examples here today like I've been apt to do on other occasions, but just imagine, for example, a sister over here and a sister over there who couldn't get on, and they're named in the letter like that, and everybody knows their sterling characteristics. Notice Paul doesn't take sides, and notice this, he doesn't say, I beseech you, Euodias and Syntyche. He uses the word beseech twice. He gives each one separately. He says, I entreat. The word means to call to one side. He uses a Greek word. I won't pronounce it, it's about that long. But it means to call to one side. So he addresses Euodias as if he was there and saying, Euodias, come up here alongside of me. Syntyche, you come over here alongside of me. Now look, you be one mind in the Lord. Never mind about this fellow in the middle. You be one line in the Lord. You come either side of me. And he virtually, in this epistle, called those two sisters out in front. And then, brethren and sisters, he names two brethren in the audience. Everybody knew, one by name, the other one didn't need a name. And he says, I want you two brethren to cooperate to reconcile these two sisters, and I want the whole ecclesia to cooperate in the reconciliation of these two women. Now, what a fantastic testimony that would be to that ecclesia. You could not possibly do that in an ecclesia of lesser ability than these. Because you see, brothers and sisters, I know ecclesias where there are some wonderful people. I've got a couple in my mind now. Whose work in the truth is exemplary. And I know that there's a bit of friction between them because of that. Shouldn't be that way, but it is. And I know this. But I, for example, wouldn't dare write to their ecclesia and ask the ecclesia to cooperate to bring them together, because the ecclesia is divided down the middle too, and one half for that brother and one half for that brother. And it wouldn't be any good appealing to anyone in that audience to try and help the reconciliation, because if you appeal to a brother on this side, you'd have to get someone on that side, and then you'd instead of having two brethren and fighting and have four. But here's an ecclesia who obviously saw these two sisters drifting apart, and nobody agreed with it. They all disagreed with it, obviously. And they wanted to see a reconciliation. And so Paul calls to all of my fellow labourers, my other fellow labourers, which were the Philippians, to assist in the reconciliation that should take place. Now you imagine that. You imagine that. And you know, he caps it off beautifully when he says, concerning Euodias, Syntyche, the genuine yoke fellow, Clement, and all the fellow labourers, why, brethren and sisters, they all had their name in one book, God's book of life. What a statement. Whose names are written in the book of life? Why should they fight? God's got them all in one volume, the whole lot of them, Syntyche, Euodias concluded. All in one volume. And they can't get on. Ridiculous, says the Apostle Paul. These two sisters must be reconciled. And there, I believe, epitomised in those two women, we had the problem which was facing the Philippian ecclesia. A problem, brethren and sisters, which was almost inevitable in an ecclesia of such a calibre where flesh is flesh. And I believe, I'd like to believe, I feel it almost impossible not to accept this fact, that that appeal would have been acceded to, that those two sisters would have become one in the Lord. I think that would have happened. And you know, as we look upon that, we see a tremendous exhortation, don't we? We must let nothing come into our lives, brethren and sisters, not even our own abilities, as it were, which God is using. There's no such thing as human ability at any rate, but not even our own talents, put it that way, that God is using. We must never allow that in any way, shape or form to cause us to think of ourselves any better than anybody else. Let each esteem better than themselves. And if Euodias had a settled in her mind and said, well look, Syntyche's a marvellous person. I don't know how she does all that work. She writes the Apostle Paul when he's in trouble. She's always helping the saints. When he's here, she's the first at the public parks where he lectures. She gives out leaflets. She works her fingers to the bone. She's a marvellous sister. And as Syntyche can say the same about Euodias. What a woman. I don't know how she does it. If each would esteem better than themselves, this problem would never have arisen. But it does arise. And hence we had that problem. So you see, brothers and sisters, they were not perfect. And this was the only fault which Paul, in any way or form, shape or form, refers to in this epistle. Now, just as another matter of interest, we have in this epistle, I'm talking now in generalities of this epistle, to give you some idea of what sort of people they were, what sort of letter this is we're going to study. There's a key word which appears 17 times. It's a word, which a Greek word, which the English spelling is C-H-A-I-R-O, which I suppose, I don't know, would be pronounced Cairo. And it means to be cheerful, but I don't see how that matches. But still, be that as it may, but that's the word. It's the Greek word Cairo, which means to be cheerful. Basically, that's what it means. Or to be calmly happy. You know, when a person is settled in their mind, they're calm, they're assured, they know that they are in the love of God, they're walking in the footsteps of Christ to the best of their ability, they fail, but they have an advocate with the Father, there are people who are settled in their mind, those people are happy people. They don't have to get around with a long face and appear unto men to fast. They are men and women who have cheerful disposition. Their very cheerfulness is a testimony to their settled way of life and mind. And that's basically the root meaning of the word Cairo, to be cheerful, to be calmly happy. And it's rendered in this epistle by the words joy, rejoice, and gladness. And 17 times it appears in this epistle. And I'll give them to you now. In verse 4 of chapter 1, Paul prays for them with gladness, or joy as he has it there. In verse 18, Paul saw the preaching of the truth, whether it brought him persecution or whether it brought him freedom. He says, I therein do rejoice, yea, and I will rejoice. And twice he uses that term in chapter 1 and verse 18. In verse 25, he sees the cooperation of the Philippians as being such that he says that for their furtherance and joy of faith, he would prefer to live rather than die. He would rather die and be with Christ, he said. But that you might be furthered in your joy and faith, he said, I prefer to live. And so he uses that term to them in that place. We come over to chapter 2 again, and in verse 17, he uses the term twice when he says, yea, and if I be offered upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I joy and rejoice with you all. Perfectly happy to be so. Verse 18, he uses the term twice again. For the same cause also do ye joy and rejoice with me. In verse 28, he speaks about sending Epaphroditus back to them that they may rejoice when they receive him. And he tells them in verse 29 to receive him in the Lord with all gladness. And once again, it is our turn. And you know, brethren and sisters, he uses the term again in chapter 3 when I believe that he commences to end his epistle. When he says in verse 1, finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. And I believe that in that third chapter in verse 1, Paul was absolutely determined to finish his epistle on that note. One other matter, however, prompts him to write differently. Although he does say in verse 3 that he rejoices in Christ Jesus and has no confidence in the flesh. But I believe that in chapter 3 he went down to write, I want to say one final thing. I want this to be in your minds. Brethren, finally be cheerful. But then another matter prompts him to write further. And so we come over in chapter 4, where again the word is taken up, and he speaks about them in chapter 4 and verse 1 as my joy and crown. And once again the word joy is our term Cairo. In verse 4 he uses it twice. Rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say, rejoice. And then down in the 10th verse, he says, but I rejoice in the Lord greatly, that now at last your care hath flourished again. And so 17 times in that epistle, he uses that word which has the meaning to be cheerful, to be calmly happy, to be filled with joy. And you'll notice, brethren and sisters, that he was absolutely determined to finish on that note. He was determined. For example, in chapter 3 and verse 1, which I have mentioned, finally, my brethren, rejoice. But then he writes about another matter. Then he comes down to chapter 4 and verse 8 and he says, finally, my brethren, whatsoever things are true and honest, so on. Then he goes in verse 10, but I rejoiced in the Lord. So that he's absolutely determined that this epistle will finish on that note. Because that's how it ought to finish. And so there we have, brethren and sisters, I believe the generalities of that epistle. The type of people they were. The type of people that Paul would like to have at his side when he died. And the type of people that he was perfectly prepared to ally himself with in fellowship in all that that term embraces. Fellowship in the truest sense of the scriptural term. People who could be one with him in defeat, if you can call it defeat, dying for Christ, but in death they could be one with him. In defence and in offence, they were in absolute oneness with him. And there was no other ecclesia like that in the world. Now, they're the sort of people that Paul says, I want to be in fellowship with. And as we come to study this epistle, brethren and sisters, I want to show you some of the circumstances of life which made those people such as they were. Because, you see, when Paul came to Philippi, he came to a different region entirely. He was not heading that way, as we will see. As we come tonight, I pray that as we come tonight to deal further with the background of this epistle, because I believe the background is all important, as we come to consider it, you will see that Paul didn't go to Philippi, he was driven there. And he would not of his own choice have ever gone to that place. As the Spirit drove him right across Asia Minor and drove him right over to Philippi, where he preached the gospel of Christ. And remember this, as we'll point out tonight, the Spirit drove him across Asia Minor to bypass those big centres of Jewish influence and great commercial centres where the truth flourished later. It wasn't as if the truth wouldn't flourish here. These ecclesias had not as yet been established. The ecclesias, for example, at Ephesus and in and around this area where the big communities were, nor at Corinth. And the Spirit of God drove him straight past all those big centres and directed him inexorably to Philippi. Because God could see, brethren and sisters, that here was a crowd that was going to respond as no other. And hence, apart from the Galatian ecclesias, who were, of course, in the immediate proximity of Paul's journey, of his commencing place at Antioch, rather, apart from the Galatian ecclesias to whom he would naturally visit first geographically, the Spirit drove him right across the continent, virtually, into a completely new area. Not only new, brethren and sisters, in terms of geography. Not only did he cross the sea and come to a different land, but he came to an atmosphere which was foreign to the Apostle Paul even. He came to something which he himself was not used to. And he found a class of people which I believe the Apostle Paul would have imagined would be the last persons in the world to accept the truth. But he came to a people who were virtually free from Jews. And that's where the gospel took root. Isn't that remarkable? And we're going to see as we go into this epistle, the reasons for these people being such outstanding people as they were, they didn't have any detractors when the gospel was first preached. Because the gospel was able to be sown, brethren and sisters, and before the enemy could take the wheat out of the ground, it took root. And because it took root, it brought forth much fruit. And so pray God, as we journey with the Apostle Paul tonight across Asia Minor, that we're going to see the importance, brethren and sisters, of this tremendous work for which the Spirit of God drove him to Philippi.